On the evening of the 9th of January 1923, the New Zealand-born short story writer Catherine Mansfield died in France following a long fight against tuberculosis.
16th of January 1923. Catherine has been dead a week. Visual impressions keep coming and coming before me, always of Catherine putting on a white wreath and leaving us. Called away. Made dignified. Chosen. The feeling so often comes to me now. Yes, go on writing, of course. But into emptiness. There's no competitor. I'm cock. A lonely cock whose crowing nothing breaks of my walk. For our friendship had so much that was writing in it.
An Oddly Complete Understanding. The Story of a Literary Friendship by Cherie Rogers. With Penelope Wilton as Virginia Woolf and Rosalind Shanks as Catherine Mansfield. The narrator is Anthony Hyde.
The literary friendship of English novelist Virginia Woolf and New Zealand-born short story writer Catherine Mansfield was characterised by rivalry as much as by affection and understanding. Lyndall Gordon, author of Virginia Woolf, A Writer's Life.
I think there's a form of literary relationship that goes beyond influence. That is a kind of sharing, the way people can almost create one another. They share one another's thoughts and feelings with such infinite awareness and sympathy. And this is possibly one way we could look at the relationship of Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield, as a profound creative sharing.
Both women could only see a glimmer of this creative sharing when fellow Bloomsbury writer Lytton Strachey introduced them in London in 1916. Catherine, aged 28, was a brash and brave colonial. 34-year-old Virginia, the haughty aristocratic, was initially repelled.
We both could wish that one's first impression of K.M. was not that she stinks like a, well, civet cat that has taken to street walking. In truth, I'm a little shocked by her commonness at first sight, lined so hard and cheap. However, when this diminishes, she's so intelligent and inscrutable that she repays friendship.
Despite the rather large stumbling blocks posed by their different cultural backgrounds, Catherine and Virginia's friendship quickly grew when they discovered they had one very important thing in common: writing.
Even now, I think it's very difficult to convince people that for a woman, her profession, her job, is the most important thing in her life.
Kate Fulbrook, author of the biography Catherine Mansfield.
For Catherine Mansfield and Virginia Woolf, this was most definitely the case. And I believe that that recognition was terribly important for both of them.
I think what really brought them together was writing. To my mind, it was essentially a professional relationship, and a rather bodiless relationship if one compared it with Virginia Woolf's other literary friendship with Vita Sackville-West, which was more of an affair, if we put affair in inverted commas. But what she liked in Vita Sackville-West was unqualified adulation. She didn't get unqualified adulation from Catherine Mansfield. I think what they shared was very serious talk about what Virginia Woolf calls in her diary our precious art.
On a more intimate level, Catherine and Virginia could only sense that the other had been deeply scarred by their life experiences and were careful to hide behind psychological masks. There is evidence that Virginia Woolf had been sexually abused when she was a girl by her stepbrother. When Catherine met her, Virginia had only recently come through a harrowing mental breakdown, prompted by her work on her first novel, The Voyage Out. But when writing to their mutual friend, Lady Ottilyn Murrell, Catherine could only speculate on the truth behind her friend's composed social mask.
I wonder if you've heard from Virginia. I had a mysterious little postcard from Leonard on Saturday saying that Virginia was ill. But since that, nothing. I think that she is still very delicate, and I shouldn't imagine she was ever well enough to leave her own home and surroundings. I dined with her one evening last week, and she was charming. I do like her tremendously. But I felt then for the first time the strange, trembling, glinting quality of her mind. And quite for the first time, she seemed to me to be one of those Dostoevsky women whose innocence has been hurt. Immediately, I decided that I understood her completely.
Lady Ottoline also perceptively sensed the price Virginia paid for her protective social mask.
Virginia and Leonard Woolf have been here for the weekend. I thought her extraordinarily beautiful and supremely eminent. When I stretched out a hand to feel another woman, I found only a very lovely, clear intellect. She does not seem to realize human beings as they are, but has a fantastic vision of them as strange birds or fishes living in air or water in an unreal world. Her eyes are like falcon's eyes and express so little. Again and again, I felt she was like a great bird sailing by that alights to parley for a few moments and then resumes her flight. As long as she can live in her dream, I think she is happy. But I believe at times she realizes her isolation and that life presents an insoluble problem to her. She flies above the earth, but has no contact with heaven.
And Virginia could only guess at the scandalous truth behind Catherine's social mask. Her early lesbian affairs, her brief one-day marriage to a musician to cover up her pregnancy by another man, she later miscarried and divorced, and the gonorrhea she contracted from a lover. Such matters were carefully tucked away from view.
I think Catherine feels unsure of her position, partly because she's a New Zealander and is not as yet very easy or natural in England, and she's constantly playing different parts. She looks at times rather like an early Renoir, but then also she is like a Japanese doll, a smooth mask, as if she kept it still and impassive to hide behind, as anyone else might hold up a fan.
Catherine was now living with the critic John Middleton Murray, and had assumed an impenetrable social mask, as Virginia Woolf's husband Leonard reveals in his memoirs.
When we first knew Catherine, she was extraordinarily amusing. She would sit very upright on the edge of a chair or sofa and tell at immense length a kind of saga of her experiences as an actress. There was not a shadow of a gleam of a smile on her mask of a face, and the extraordinary funniness of the story was increased by the flashes of her astringent wit.
It was against a background of literary dinner parties that Virginia and Catherine began to allow their masks to drop. Not entirely, but enough to let their feelings of affection for each other grow and deepen.
24th of June, 1917. Virginia, dear, I shall love to come and dine on Wednesday night with you alone. Ever since I read your letter, I've been writing to you and a bit haunted by you. I long to see you again. My God, I love to think of you, Virginia, as my friend. Don't cry me an ardent creature, or say, with your head a little on one side, smiling as though you knew some enchanting secret.
Well, Catherine, we shall see.
But pray consider how rare is it to find someone with the same passion for writing that you have, who desires to be scrupulously truthful with you, and to give you the freedom of the city without any reserves at all. Oh, curse it. Here is the laundry boy, snatching at my flying feet. Yours ever, K.M.
27th of June, 1917. I had an odd talk with Catherine Mansfield last night. She seems to have gone every sort of hog since she was 17, which is interesting. I also think she has a much better idea of writing than most.
Virginia became increasingly intrigued by Catherine's ribald and risque sagas, carefully censored, of course.
It seems to me that Catherine Mansfield reflected the dark side of Virginia Woolf's moon. Virginia Woolf always thought in terms of a night and day kind of existence, the daylight existence being the sort of public existence, the kind of existence that would have been written about in a Victorian novel. And she was interested in exploring the hidden, the unknown modes of being. One perhaps could say that all the moderns, the great moderns, are very interested in transgressing the limits of ordinary experience. Virginia Woolf puts it this way in a very early review of 1908. She says that one must crack through the paving stone and be enveloped in a mist.
Catherine and Virginia may have found it difficult at times to see beneath each other's masks, but they were particularly interested in exploring the unconscious in their work. Besides, the First World War was already fast destroying the old Victorian and Edwardian social order. Virginia broke with traditional style in her short impressionistic story, Kew Gardens, written in 1917, in which she recorded the thoughts of people walking past a flower bed on a hot July afternoon.
The figures of men and women straggled past the flower bed with a curiously irregular movement, not unlike that of the white and blue butterflies who crossed the turf in zigzag flights from bed to bed. The man was about 6 inches in front of the woman, strolling carelessly, while she bore on with greater purpose, only turning her head now and then to see that the children were not too far behind. The man kept his distance in front of the woman purposely, though perhaps unconsciously, for he wanted to go on with his thoughts. 15 years ago, I came here with Lily, he thought. We sat somewhere over there, by the lake, and I begged her to marry me all through the hot afternoon. How the dragonfly kept circling round us. How clearly I see the dragonfly, and her shoe with the square silver buckle at the toe. All the time I spoke, I saw her shoe, and when it moved impatiently, I knew without looking up what she was going to say. The whole of her seemed to be in her shoe. And my love, my desire, were in the dragonfly. For some reason I thought that if it settled there on that leaf, the broad one with the red flower in the middle of it, if the dragonfly settled on the leaf, she would say yes, at once. But the dragonfly went round and round. It never settled anywhere. Of course not. Happily not. Or I shouldn't be walking here with Eleanor and the children.
Yes, your flower bed is very good. There's a still, quivering, changing light over it all, and a sense of those couples dissolving in the bright air which fascinates me. We have got the same job, Virginia, and it is really very curious and thrilling that we should both, quite apart from each other, be after so very nearly the same thing. We are, you know. There's no denying it.
Earlier in 1917, Leonard Woolf thought it would be a good idea to keep his wife occupied with a manual diversion, to give her a break from the ardours of writing, always a threat since her breakdown after writing The Voyage Out. The result was the birth of the Hogarth Press, and a supportive hand to their friend Catherine.
Our press arrived on Tuesday. We unpacked it with enormous excitement and carried it into the drawing room, set it on its stand, and discovered it was smashed in half. It is a great weight, and they never screw it down. But the shop has probably got a spare part. One has great blocks of type which have to be divided into their separate letters and fonts, and then put into the right partitions. The work of ages, especially when you mix the H's and the N's, as I did yesterday. We get so absorbed we can't stop. I see that real printing will devour one's entire life. I'm going to see Catherine Mansfield to get a story from her.
The story Virginia obtained from Catherine was Prelude, a semi-autobiographical novella set in New Zealand which documents the emotional life of the Burnell family. Catherine, like Virginia in Kew Gardens, tackles the innermost feelings and thoughts on love and marriage as Linda Burnell, the young wife in the tale, walks into the garden late one night with her mother.
She put her hand on her mother's arm and they walked down the steps, round the island, and on to the main drive that led to the front gates. Looking at the aloe from below, she could see the long, sharp thorns that edged the leaves, and at the sight of them, her heart grew hard. She particularly liked the long, sharp thorns. Nobody would dare to come near the ship or to follow after. Not even my Newfoundland dog, thought she, that I'm so fond of in the daytime. For she really was fond of him. She loved and admired and respected him tremendously. Oh, better than anyone else in the world. She knew him through and through. He was the soul of truth and decency, and for all his practical experience, he was awfully simple, easily pleased, and easily hurt. If only he wouldn't jump at her so and bark so loudly and watch her with such eager, loving eyes. He was too strong for her. She had always hated things that rush at her from a child. There were times when he was frightening, really frightening. When she just had not screamed at the top of her voice, "You are killing me!" And at those times she had longed to say the most coarse, hateful things. "You know I'm very delicate. You know as well as I do that my heart is affected. And the doctor has told you I may die any moment. I've had 3 great lumps of children already." Yes. Yes, it was true. Linda snatched her hand from her mother's arm. For all her love and respect and admiration, she hated him. And how tender he always was after times like those. How submissive, how thoughtful. He would do anything for her. He longed to serve her. Linda heard herself saying in a weak voice, "Stanley, would you light a candle?" She had been walking with her head bent, looking at nothing. Now she looked up and about her. They were standing by the red and white camellia trees. Beautiful were the rich, dark leaves, spangled with light, and the round flowers that perch among them, like red and white birds. Linda pulled a piece of verbena and crumpled it, and held her hands to her mother. "Delicious," said the old woman. "Are you cold, child? Are you trembling?" "Yes, your hands are cold. We'd better go back to the house."
July the 12th, 1918. Yesterday and the day before we spent gluing the book and have now paid all our debts, so that I suppose a great many tongues are now busy with K.M. I myself find a kind of beauty about the story. A little vapourish, I admit, and freely watered with some of her cheap realities, but it has the living power, the detached existence of a work of art.
With Prelude and Kew Gardens, Catherine and Virginia had laid the foundations for the new art they wished to pursue, each in her separate way. Catherine through the medium of the short story, Virginia mainly through the novel. But Claire Tomalin, author of Catherine Mansfield, A Secret Life, believes their work is very different. Virginia Woolf's characters are rooted in a particular society and a particular culture.
This historical and cultural element is very, very important. You feel that they read books, that their families know where they've lived for a long time. This, of course, is not so in Mansfield. I mean, Mansfield's absolutely characteristic approach is to write about people who are in transit, people who are in a void, people who are moving from one place to another. I mean, very often, in a way, the theme of the story itself is this sense of movement. I think this is one of the things that has made Mansfield stories so appealing to a lot of modern, particularly young women readers, because that you can identify in some way with that sense of not knowing where you belong, where you're going, feeling that life is exciting and challenging, at the same time dangerous. And I don't think you find that in Virginia Woolf at all. But they shared something extremely interesting in their writing. I think they were both interested in the question of gender. They both disliked male dominance, male brutality. Catherine Mansfield writes about the Bernal family very much in terms of sympathy for the mother who wants to withdraw from male dominance, male sexual aggression. Virginia Woolf also shows her women characters turning to other women, uneasy with the male.
By 1918, Catherine Mansfield was hard at work on short stories, such as Bliss and Je ne parle pas français, and Virginia was writing her second novel, Night and Day.
I believe that the main thing in beginning a novel is to feel not that you can write it,
but that it exists on the far side of a gulf, which words can't cross, that it's to be pulled through only in a breathless anguish.
I'm in a furious working mood. This always happens to me when the flesh is weak. But it is such superb fun to sit here and write and write.
When Catherine wrote that the flesh is weak, she was referring to a bad chill which she'd caught. It was to be an ominous development.
I have been strictly in bed for days, nearly weeks, with my left water wing, alias my lung, entirely out of action for the time, and strapped up in plaster which gives off waves of smell like new varnish on an inside cabin wall. Dry pleurisy, an old complaint of mine. Still quite unable to grasp the fact that life really has given me such a cuff and a kiss as this old attack. For the doctor says I must never stay in England for another winter, but must leave in September and not come back until April. And at present, as soon as I am well enough, he has given me a medical certificate for the south of France.
March 18, 1918. On Sunday, the burden of visitors was oppressive. The list speaks for itself. Gerald and Saxon lunch, Saxon tea, Barbara, Nick, Middleton Murray dinner. Poor Murray snarled and scowled with the misery of his lot. He works all day and writes when he comes home. Worst of all, K.M. has been very ill with hemorrhage from the lungs out in France and has to be brought home, which is difficult, in order to see how bad she is.
I saw Dr. Ainger yesterday, and he said, yes, there is no doubt. I have definitely got consumption. He appreciated that a sanatorium would kill me much faster than cure me. It's a second lunatic asylum to me. Therefore, I am to try a cure at home. Home is to be either Hampstead or Highgate or further afield. Must live in a summer house, find the summer, eat and drink milk, and not get excited or run or leap or worry about anything. You know, all the old wise saws. In fact, repeat fortissimo with a good strong accent on the second note, she must lead the life of a child of eight, and so on. But you see, I'm ever so gay, with long beams coming from my fingers and sparks flying from my toes as I walk.
Catherine Mansfield and Middleton Murray had nothing. They were very, very poor. Catherine Mansfield had an allowance from her father that he paid throughout her life, no matter what a scapegrace she behaved as. But besides that, they were scrambling. Murray had been made bankrupt. Catherine Mansfield was dying without the amenities of dying properly around her.
But Catherine's return to London did enable her to resume her friendship with Virginia.
I had a most satisfactory and fascinating renewal of my friendship with Catherine Mansfield. She is extremely ill. As usual, we came to an oddly complete understanding. My theory is that I get down to what is true rock in her through the numerous vapours and pores which sicken or bewilder most of our friends. It's her love of writing, I think.
1 November, 1918. Dear Virginia, I should love to see you one afternoon next week. Would Wednesday suit you? I'm a very dull dog and in bed, but I try to look as though I were there for pleasure and not from necessity. But do come. There is a power of things to be talked over. Murray will send you a very pretty, delicate little flowery map of the way. It's extremely easy to find, and I swear to God it's not more than 8 minutes from the tube station.
I go up. She gets up very slowly from her writing table. A glass of milk and a medicine bottle stands there. There are also piles of novels. Everything is very tidy, bright, and somehow like a doll's house. At once, or almost, we get out of shyness. She half lays on the sofa by the window. She has her look of a Japanese doll, with the fringe combed quite straight across her forehead. Sometimes we look very steadfastly at each other, as though we have reached some durable relationship, independent of the changes of the body, through the eyes. Hers are beautiful eyes, rather dog-like, brown, very wide apart, with a steady, slow, rather faithful and sad expression. She looks very ill, very drawn, and moves languidly, drawing herself across the room like some suffering animal. We reach a kind of certainty in talk about books, or rather about our writings, which I think has something durable about it.
Virginia, I wonder why I feel an intense joy that you are a writer, that you live for writing. I do. You are immensely important in my world, Virginia. I didn't say a quarter that I wanted to yesterday. But it will keep.
Keep it did, for soon after an unusually long silence descended, a silence that left Virginia baffled. She felt their friendship was becoming markedly one-sided.
Virginia Woolf did, in a sense, act as the wooer, the pursuer. She sent Catherine flowers, she wrote to her, she sent her cigarettes, she recommended a doctor to her in Hampstead, one of her own doctors. And she felt hurt. She was often hurt by the feeling that Catherine was mysterious, that Catherine withdrew, that Catherine didn't respond, didn't take any notice. I think Virginia Woolf failed to understand how ill Catherine was, how often she was in pain, how often she really could hardly cope with her own life, let alone a friendship.
It is at this moment extremely doubtful whether I have the right to class Catherine among my friends. Quite possibly I shall never see her again. Upstairs I have letters in which she speaks of finding the thought of me a joy, dwelling upon my writing with excitement. I have letters making appointments, pressing for visits, adding postscripts of thanks and affection to visits already paid. But the last is dated December, and it is now February. The question interests, amuses, and also slightly, no, very decidedly, pains me. The truth is, I suppose, that one of the conditions unexpressed but understood of our friendship has been precisely that it was almost entirely founded on quicksands. It has been marked by curious slides and arrests. For months I've heard nothing of her. Then we have met again upon what has the appearance of solid ground. We have been intimate, intense perhaps rather than open, but to me at any rate our intercourse has always been interesting and mingled with quite enough of the agreeable personal element to make one fond, if that is the word, as well as curious. I was at pains to go up to Hampstead every week since mid-October or November, I suppose. And then what happened? I go away for Christmas, and we send small, bright presents, carefully timed to arrive on Christmas Day. I add to mine one, if not two, long and affectionate letters. I propose to come as soon as I get back, but meanwhile, for no reason given or to be guessed at with any certainty, she falls silent. I get no thanks, no inquiries. February 21st, 1919. All this is made to appear rather fine, drawn, and exaggerated by the simple fact that I have a letter this morning from K.M.
Dear Virginia, alas, I have just had another inoculation, and by tea time tomorrow I shall be sailing on tropic seas. I am trying a new treatment which gives me a high temperature for 48 hours each time it is applied. I wonder if you could and would come next Monday. I want very much to see you. I wish I were more physically stable. It's dreadful misery.
The inscrutable woman remains unscrutable, I'm glad to say. No apologies or sense of apologies due. At once she flung down her pen and plunged, as if we'd been parted for only 10 minutes, with the greatest freedom and animation until I had to catch my train. And again, as usual, I find with Catherine what I don't find with the other clever women, a sense of ease and interest, which is, I suppose, due to her caring so genuinely, if so differently, from the way I care about our precious art.
I think that Virginia Woolf and Catherine Mansfield gave each other a delighted sense that they were not the only ones doing what they were doing. If you're dealing with two people, two women in particular, who feel that they have to go through life masked and are interested, even obsessed, in exploring this subject in their fiction, the sense of finding a kindred spirit must have been intensely moving, I think. And I should have thought that for both of them it was a kind of professional prop for sanity, the sense of not being alone.
10th of April, 1919. My dear Virginia, I have burned to write to you ever since you were here last. I have read your article on modern novels. You write so damn well, so devilish well. There are these little others, you know, dodging and stumbling along, taking a sniff here and a stare there. And there is your mind, so accustomed to taking the air in the grand manner. To tell you the truth, I am proud of your writing. I read and I think, how she beats them. But I positively must see you soon. I want to talk over so much.
That's the clue. Work. Virginia admired Catherine's sort of professional reviewing. They both took reviewing very seriously. And Virginia comments on Catherine's neatness and her piles of books and how she is at the heart of the professional literary world. This meant a lot to them both, I think. They were aware of themselves as being in a tradition of literary women, which goes right back to the 18th century, Mary Wollstonecraft, women who'd worked on literary journals and written their own books. And I think this is something that we all value in them, that they're one of the high points of this tradition, which has been terribly important to women, because it's been one of the very few ways in which women have been able to feel they stood in some sense as equals with men, that they could achieve as much as men, and that they could earn, and that they could be valued in society.
Virginia made a total of 7 trips to Catherine's house in Hampstead from May to July 1919. She would have continued to visit, but for a new crisis.
This is the first day I am up again and able to write letters. I have been rather badly ill, and it's left me for the moment without an idea except that I must go abroad until next April. I can't manage anything for the next 6 months. I must just lie in the air and try and turn into a decent creature. Do not think I am forgetful of you. You would not believe me if you knew how often you are in my heart and mind. I love thinking of you. I will write again very soon. This is just really a wave.
In the autumn of 1919, while Catherine was in Italy, Virginia's novel Night and Day was published. It's a traditional narrative of an upper-class young woman who struggles to find an identity and happiness. Catherine Mansfield was asked to review it for a literary journal.
I am doing Virginia for this week's novel. I don't like it. My private opinion is that it is a lie in the soul. The war never has been. That is what its message is. I don't want, God forbid, mobilization and the violation of Belgium. But the novel can't just leave the war out. There must have been a change of heart. I feel, in the profoundest sense, that nothing can ever be the same. That as artists we are traitors if we feel otherwise. We have to take it into account and find new expressions, new moulds for our new thoughts and feelings.
28th of November, 1919. K.M. wrote a review which irritated me. I thought I saw spite in it. A decorous, elderly dullard, she describes me. Jane Austen, up to date.
Virginia was hurt, but she didn't completely ignore Catherine's review.
And I think that possibly in Virginia Woolf's next novel, she takes this in so far as she goes on to write about Jacob Flanders, who epitomises the lost generation. And again, in Mrs. Dalloway, she writes about Septimus Warren Smith, who is, after all, a shell-shocked victim of the First World War. She was never able to go quite back to that warless novel she wrote, up to 1919.
The furore over Catherine's review, however, did unmask the envy and jealousy the friends felt towards each other.
How I envy Virginia. No wonder she can write. There is always in her writing a calm freedom of expression as though she were at peace. Her roof over her, her possessions round her, and her man somewhere within call. What have I done that I should have all the handicaps, plus a disease?
I think in many ways Virginia Woolf was more jealous of Catherine Mansfield than Catherine Mansfield of Virginia Woolf, because of the writing. And because Catherine Mansfield was absolutely assured about her vocation as a writer, whereas Virginia Woolf was always questioning herself, always wondering, was she good enough to carry on? Catherine Mansfield tended to worry about, is this piece good enough, or is that piece good enough? Not, will I ever be a writer? Virginia Woolf was still worried about this kind of thing during the period of their association.
I threw down Bliss with the exclamation, she's done for. Indeed, I don't see how much faith in her as a woman or writer can survive that sort of story. I shall have to accept the fact, I'm afraid, that her mind is a very thin soil, laid an inch or two deep upon very barren rock. Bliss is long enough to give her a chance of going deeper. Instead, she is content with superficial smartness, and the whole conception is poor, cheap, not the vision, however imperfect, of an interesting mind. She writes badly, too.
But such vitriolic feelings didn't stop Virginia from pursuing her friendship with Catherine when she returned from one of her frequent trips to the Mediterranean.
31st of May, 1920. I had my interview with K.M. on Friday. A steady, discomposing formality and coldness at first. Inquiries about house and so on. No pleasure or excitement at seeing me. It struck me that she is of the cat kind. Alien, composed, always solitary and observant. And then we talked about solitude, and I found her expressing my feelings as I've never heard them expressed. Whereupon we fell into step, and as usual talked as easily as though 8 months were minutes. Kay and I once more got upon literature. A queer effect she produces of someone apart, entirely self-centred, altogether concentrated upon her art, almost fierce to me about it. I pretending I couldn't write.
No one else can write stories except you. Kew Gardens was the right gesture. It was a turning point.
But Night and Day...
An amazing achievement. Why, we've not had such a thing since I don't know when.
But I thought you didn't like it. Then she said she could pass an examination in it. Would I come and talk about it, lunch? So I'm going to lunch. But what does her reviewing mean, then? Or is she emotional with me? Anyhow, once more as keenly as ever, I feel a common certain understanding between us, a queer sense of being like, not only about literature, and I think it's independent of gratified vanity. I can talk straight out to her. 25th of August, 1920. I went to London on Monday and said goodbye to Catherine. I had my euphemism at parting about coming again before she goes, but it is useless to extend these farewell visits. They have something crowded and unnaturally calm, too, about them. And after all, visits can't do away with the fact that she goes for 2 years, is ill, and heaven knows when we shall meet again. We propose to write to each other. She will send me her diary. Shall we? Will she? If I were left to myself, I should, being the simpler, the more direct of the two. I can't follow people who don't do the obvious things in these ways. Strange how little we know our friends.
During the time that Virginia Woolf knew Catherine Mansfield was simply preoccupied with her dying. So there were things that got in the way. Other things that got in the way included the malicious gossip of mutual friends that tended to set the two women against each other. So the friendship was a rocky one. It was a difficult one. And I think at times Virginia Woolf simply didn't register what was going on.
Early in September, Catherine left for the south of France, and apart from one brief trip back to England, She was to spend the next 2.5 years desperately searching for a cure for her illness. The two friends were never to see each other again. Virginia, learning from Murray that she was lonely, did write to her in the winter of 1921, but received no reply. The following August, she heard a rumour circulating amongst the Bloomsbury set that Catherine was completely cured. If so, her silence was puzzling.
I cough and cough, and at each breath a dragging, boiling, bubbling sound is heard. I feel that my whole chest is boiling. I sip water, spit, sip, spit. I feel I must break my heart. And I can't expand my chest. It's as though the chest has collapsed. Life is getting a new breath. Nothing else counts. It is hard. It is hard to make a good death.
Catherine had tried various treatments for tuberculosis. All had failed. Sensing the end was near, she began to shed her earthly belongings and relationships, even withdrawing from John Middleton Murray. She sought spiritual solace at a commune in Fontainebleau run by Russian cult leader George Ivanovich Gurdjieff. But Murray was with her when the end came.
I arrived at the Gurdjieff Institute early in the afternoon of January the 9th, 1923. Catherine was very pale, but radiant. Later in the evening, we went to sit in the salon. At about 10 o'clock, she said she was tired and began to go to her room. As she slowly climbed the big staircase to the first floor where her room was, she was seized by a fit of coughing. I took her arm and helped her into her room. No sooner were we inside than the cough became a paroxysm. Suddenly, a great gush of blood poured from her mouth. It seemed to be suffocating her.
I believe I'm going to die.
Doctor! Doctor! Quick, up here!
Kay died in 10 minutes of hemorrhage. I never gave her credit for all her physical suffering and the effect it must have had on embittering her. Did she care for me? Sometimes she would say so, would kiss me, would look at me as if, is the sentiment, her eyes would like always to be faithful. She would promise never, never to forget. That was what we said at the end of our last talk. She would send me her diary to read and would write always. For our friendship was a real thing, we said, looking at each other quite straight. It would always go on whatever happened. What happened was, I suppose, fault findings and perhaps gossip. She never answered my letter. Yet I still feel somehow that friendship persists. Still, there are things about writing I think of and want to tell Catherine. And I was jealous of her writing. The only writing I have ever been jealous of. This made it harder to write to her. And I saw in it, perhaps from jealousy, all the qualities I disliked in her. Yet I have the feeling that I shall think of her at intervals all through life. Kay and I had our relationship, and never again shall I have one like it.
In An Oddly Complete Understanding by Cherie Rogers, Virginia Woolf was played by Penelope Wilton and Catherine Mansfield by Rosalind Shanks. Also taking part were June Barry and Cornelius Garrett. The narrator was Anthony Hyde, and the programme was produced in Bristol by John Knight.